This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Birds disappearing. Large ocean species dying off. Biggest storms ever recorded. Second hottest year on record. Polar ice melting. Oceans turning acidic. You know, it's almost time to panic! That was from my Radio EcoShock Year in Review in December 2005. Some really old radio from Alex Smith. Fast forward to 2021, when the unbelievable officially becomes the new normal. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, just issued maps of the new weird normal for the United States, and there are hot spots all over. Scientist Michael Mann says it is a mistake to make a new normal every 10 years, as NOAA does. That hides huge changes developing during our lives as the climate shifts. Extreme heat in so many parts of the Northern Hemisphere in the month of May is not normal. Toronto, Canada got summer heat of 30 degrees C, 86 Fahrenheit, before the May 24th holiday there. I grew up in Toronto. That never happened. It's crazy talk. In May 2021, it was hotter still in Moscow, reaching toward 90 degrees Fahrenheit over 32 C. Wild hot weather sent Muscovites to the water fountains, the ice cream stands. They were in their shorts in May. Not possible. 1,000 miles northeast of Moscow, near the Arctic Sea, Narayanmar, a town of 21,000 north of the Arctic Circle, saw 89.4 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 32 degrees C. French meteorologists said the previous record was 82 or 25 degrees C. Some temperatures in the Russian Arctic are the highest and the earliest ever seen. These are great big exclamation points all over the map of northern Russia. The heat seems to gather in atmospheric pools that are almost half a continent wide, but it is wavy. Europe in the same third week of May was colder than normal. But on the other side of the world, Canada's prairies went through their own late spring heat machine. That comes out on top of a drought. Wildfires have broken out in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario at a scale never seen this early in the year. Smoke from the Manitoba fires drifted over New England, making skies hazier there. Like most of the U.S. Southwest, the soil in my valley home is just dust looking for help. These are supposed to be the wet months, but homeowners have their sprinklers going, while the unexpectedly low rivers are already being pumped out by the farmers. It's not right. Halfway across America, Lake Charles, Louisiana, had more rain than anyone can stand. The ground was totally loaded with water when, this week, another storm brought 18 more inches of rain in 24 hours. A foot and a half of rain. It's just not possible. I guess you would call that an extreme precipitation event. Remember, that's the town that was hit twice by hurricanes Laura and Delta in 2020. 2 decades ago, climate scientists predicted the dry will get drier and the wet will get wetter. It all gets hotter, with some places getting hotter than most. We're in a car slowly rolling towards that climate cliff. Right now, the speed is slow enough. People could just step out and not get hurt that much. Ah, but the seats are comfortable. There's a custom video channel playing just for you right now. Some feel restrained by their seat belts. We feel safer in our cars, always have. The car is gradually picking up speed, so it will be dangerous to try and jump out later. But to our amazement, hardly anyone tries to get out. You may be hoping to crawl out of the dark years of the pandemic. Most of us will. But consumer normal, that set the planet into a fever. If we go back to burning carbon for fun, well, a whole new beast is emerging out of the heat.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating, or is it only mine?
We're going to talk about, in this show, just one deadly way this could unfold anytime, even this summer.
Radio EcoShock.
What could be the most deadly climate-driven disaster in the United States and probably most world cities? You're about to find out, and not in 2050, it's possible even this summer. News from a paper led by our guest Brian Stone Jr. just hit the New York Times, CBS News, and a lot more. Brian is a professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where he directs the Urban Climate Lab. From Atlanta, Georgia, Brian Stone Jr., welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex. I'm thrilled to be on the show.
Well, in 2012, you published a book, The City and the Coming Climate, so maybe this isn't big news to you, but when you say this, and I'll quote you, a widespread blackout during an intense heat wave may be the deadliest climate-related event we can imagine. Well, most of us have not imagined that. Brian, what do you picture happening?
I focused on this in the book, as you mentioned, Alex, and so I guess what's new here for me, as well as probably your listeners, is the growing potential to have a blackout during a heat wave. And so I think the first thing to observe is that heat is the deadliest threat from really the natural world to us. Of all the climate-related health impacts, heat is the greatest. It's far more deadly than hurricanes, far more deadly than tornadoes. And that's in the present period. And so for most of us, as temperatures are rising, we can take comfort in the fact that we have air conditioning, at least in the United States. But when we have a blackout, obviously, that protective air conditioning is removed, and we are exposed to what are increasingly dangerous levels of heat. And so that's what the paper was focused on.
When you talk about mass deaths, some might accuse you of exaggerating, but then we remember at least 14,000 people died in their homes in France in the European heat wave of 2003, and at least 700 people a day died in Moscow in their heat wave in 2010. So even without power failures, heat alone can be a mass casualty event, don't you think?
Yeah, these are really big numbers that you're mentioning. And so again, you know, hurricanes capture the imagination. They are absolutely increasing over time, at least the most intense hurricanes, and we do see a death toll from these events, but it does not match the more silent threat of a heat wave. And so, you know, you referenced some significant events, but year over year, right now in the United States, we're experiencing about 12,000 deaths a year from extreme heat. So these are big numbers.
It's amazing, but I do recall a couple of our guests suggested heat deaths had actually gone down in the United States since cities learned to take them seriously and take action. First of all, is that true? And second, have we become complacent?
I don't think it's true. There's always a debate over the numbers of heat-related deaths because it's hard to measure directly. To diagnose hypothermia or heat stroke, you need to have a core body temperature that's about 106, 170 degrees. And so usually by the time a victim arrives at the hospital, they have cooled down. It's a rather morbid topic. But it is difficult to directly code a heat death. But we can look statistically at the number of deaths in the United States day over day, particularly in the summer, and see how it correlates with temperature. And we find that it's a pretty strong correlation. And so whether you're dying directly of heat or whether the heat is an underlying condition and you have cardiovascular disease, that's a heat-related death, and those numbers appear to be increasing pretty consistently over time.
I think we all presume that cooling centers can take in people without AC. What is the problem with that?
Well, there are two major problems. One, we don't have anywhere near enough cooling centers. And so, again, I think this is part of the larger kind of cultural orientation to heat that perceives it as less threatening than it is. And so we tend not to have a large number of cooling centers. In my own city of Atlanta, we have about five formally designated cooling centers. These tend to be community centers, you know, basketball courts, and they're not very large. And so that represents a challenge if we get an unprecedented heat wave, and in particular if we have a blackout, because none of the three cities we looked at in the study, which was Atlanta, Detroit, and Phoenix, have required backup power generation. And so if you do have a blackout with a heat wave, even having a large number of cooling centers, and I don't think any U.S. city has a sufficiently large number, that's not going to be protective of the population if there is not backup power.
That's really shocking that they don't have backup power. I just don't understand that. Meanwhile, most climate dialogue is about the global average temperatures, but several EcoShock guests warned us that regions get much hotter than a global average, and then cities get much hotter than that. What predictions are there out there about urban heat and that you're working with?
Well, very few. My research group, the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, has been focused on this for a long time, and we remain one of the few groups that's trying to measure how rapidly cities, in particular large cities, are warming year over year. And we find that in the United States, the largest cities tend to be warming at a rate that is more than double that of the planet. And so if you're planning on a rate of warming that's consistent with the planetary average, you are largely underestimating how rapidly your city is heating up.
We're talking so far about the outside heat measurements. What is going on inside people's homes where most folks are trying to shelter during the heat wave?
That is the condition about which we know the least, Alex, and that was the core focus of our study. And so there are many studies that have tried to forecast moving forward how temperatures will rise outside. It's difficult then to understand how temperatures will be impacted on the inside of our homes. And so for this study, we looked at a historical heat wave. And so this is not a future heat wave, but one of historical intensity in these three cities. And then we used a building energy model to simulate what the temperatures would be inside the homes with a functional grid. And then that assumes that those who normally have air conditioning would have the air conditioning running, and then with a non-functioning electrical grid. And so how high would temperatures get inside during a heat wave without power? And what we find is that in some housing types, it would be hotter inside than outside. And this is particularly alarming in a city like Phoenix, where you have heat wave temperatures that are greater than 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're seeing temperatures inside the homes reaching more than 110 degrees. And that's obviously a very hazardous condition.
Why are poorer people already at higher risk during a heat wave, whether the power stays on or off?
Yeah, great question. And there are a number of reasons. One of those reasons is that there is less access to air conditioning. And so we find that lower income households in our three cities are more than 20% less likely to have air conditioning. And so in a city like Phoenix, most people have air conditioning. But there's a sizable population that just won't use the air conditioner because it's too expensive. And so lower-income households tend to fewer have air conditioning, fewer use it if they have it. And so that is placing them at a particular risk. And then we also see other vulnerabilities associated with just poor baseline health in lower-income communities and communities of color. And so this is a particular vulnerability that is part of really a climate justice issue, is that there are populations that are more at risk even today than others. And it's typically driven by income and by race.
Well, and yeah, you can see why some people might be afraid to turn it on when you look at what happened to the people in Texas who had a variable rate. They were paying thousands of dollars for a couple of days' worth of electricity during that winter storm in February. I want to get to the international view, though, here. The upcoming COP climate talks in Scotland, they'll deal with global average temperature safety guardrails, as they see it, of about 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C of warming. But meanwhile, I spoke with Chinese scientist Lei Zhao, and he told us world cities are projected to go up to 4 degrees C hotter and beyond. Brian, would you talk to us about the urban heat island effect, which you've studied for years?
So there are four elements of the design and operation of cities that make them hotter. Cities are just hotter environments. This is absent the global greenhouse effect, although the global greenhouse effect is amplifying this. And so in cities, we know we remove a lot of the natural vegetation. And so in my part of the world, in the eastern United States, that tends to be forest cover. And so if you're cutting down trees in a region in Georgia, or you're doing it in the Brazilian Amazon, you're raising temperatures. You're losing the shading that we've all experienced and that cooling effect, but even more importantly, evapotranspiration. And this is basically the release of water vapor to cool down the air, and trees do that very effectively. And so just removing the natural vegetation, whether it's trees or grass, whatever it is, will likely raise temperatures. And then in cities, we double down on that result by bringing in high heat capacity materials. And so asphalt and concrete and roof shingling. These are materials that absorb heat and store it very well, and so that raises temperatures even further. And then we have a lot of waste heat that's emitted in cities. And so if you do run your air conditioning, you are just mechanically removing heat from in the building and venting it outside. And that heat aggregates across a lot of buildings. Tailpipes are releasing a lot of heat, too. And so that elevates temperatures. And then lastly, the three-dimensional morphology is what we call it as planners, the three-dimensional shape of cities. You can think about downtown street canyons with high buildings and vertical surfaces. That can trap outgoing heat and further raise temperatures. So the combination of these four elements of cities can raise temperatures on a typical afternoon in the summer by, 5 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that's quite some additional warming that you see in cities that you don't see in rural areas.
It's pretty shocking. I've seen photos of streets in Mumbai where, it's just a wall of air conditioners in every window. And you walk down those alleyways and it's like going through a hairdryer or something. Meanwhile, I want to switch to something that's in your paper that really interested me. Climate scientists worry about so-called compound events. An example you cite in your paper could be wildfires breaking out during a drought, and that's really possible this year in the U.S. Southwest. But your study goes further, adding non-climatic stressors. Talk to us about that, Brian, please.
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with two weather-related events happening at the same time. And so you mentioned a wildfire during a heat wave or a heat wave in a drought. These weather events are related, and so to see more than one extreme event happening at the same time is not that unexpected or unusual. But, of course, these events also stress our infrastructure. And so, the human impacts of these extreme natural events are mediated by the infrastructure of the city, which includes the electrical grid, includes our transportation systems, and includes our air conditioning systems. And so if we have a breakdown in critical infrastructure during an extreme event, that is a particular type of compound event that is likely to be more hazardous and deadly than just a combination of two natural events. And so even the pandemic that remains unfolding right now can be conceived as a compound event in that it is, it's stressing climate change and the pandemic are stressing the impact on communities when we have, for example, a heat wave or a hurricane and we have to use shelters and we have more transmission. So we really needed to have some new language about compound events that's not just focused on weather events.
And how do you define an electricity blackout, and are they increasing in the United States?
That's a great question, and our study was not initially focused on trying to measure the frequency of blackout events, but that was ended up being a major finding. And so what we have seen is that since 2015 in the United States, the number of major blackout events, and so those are events that impact more than 50,000 customers, has more than doubled. So just in 6 years, we've seen major blackout events in the United States have more than doubled. And so we were asking that question because we simply wanted to simulate a blackout event. And so we said, well, how long would a blackout event last if it impacted more than 1 million customers, so a large city blackout? And we've had these events in the last 5 years. And so it turns out that the average number of hours of a major blackout event impacting 1 million customers is about 5 days. So that's a very long time to not have your power. And so in trying to determine what is a reasonable duration of a blackout to simulate, we also discovered that blackouts are increasing very rapidly. And this has not really been covered in the media, which is somewhat surprising to me, but the information is rather hard to get your hands on.
So your latest paper, published in Environmental Science and Technology, April 30th, is titled Compound Climate and Infrastructure Events, How Electrical Grid Failures Alters Heat Wave Risk. What brought you and your team to look into this, Brian?
Well, as I mentioned, we've been focused on how rapidly cities are warming for a long time. And so based on finding how much heat is amplified in cities and how rapidly it is increasing, we've been partnering specifically or directly with city governments to develop adaptations. How can cities manage this rising threat to their population? And so during the course of that work and those partnerships with cities, we've come to recognize that cities are not well positioned to manage extreme heat events. They have very few cooling centers. The cooling centers don't have backup generation. And so that's what led us to raise the question, well, what would be the health impacts, the potential health impacts of a heat wave if it occurred at the same time as a blackout? And the other thing I should note is that not only are blackouts increasing, they are most rapidly increasing in the summer months. And so that greater demand on the electrical grid because of all the air conditioning use is leading itself to more blackouts. So this is really a growing threat during the summer months.
Well, the energy balance in the United States has really tipped. It used to be the big energy was all used in the winter because it was, you know, you had to heat your homes. But now it seems with milder winters and really hot summers, it's going the other way.
It's true. And it's also, I mean, you mentioned the event we saw earlier this year in Texas. It's also important to mention that, you know, air conditioning is pretty much exclusively driven by electricity. There are a wider range of fuel sources for heating your home, including just burning wood. You don't really have that option when the power goes out in the summer. And so we are more vulnerable in general to energy shocks in the summer during extreme weather because our singular mode of cooling is lost.
Tell us what you found for the three cities you chose for this study.
So we focused on these three cities, Atlanta, Georgia, Detroit, Michigan, and Phoenix, Arizona, because they represent a diversity of climate types. You know, it ranges from a higher latitude city in Detroit to a dry and hot city in the southwest to a wet and hot city in the southeast. And so we wanted to capture that diversity. And then we also have a diversity of housing types. And so we're very much focused on simulating heat exposures, temperatures inside everyone's home. And so we're interested in single-story, single-family houses and multi-story houses and apartment buildings. So we wanted to capture that diversity across these three cities. And so looking at the range of impacts, and specifically what we do is we just measure what the heat index value is. And so a heat index is a combination of the temperature and the humidity inside people's homes. We're all used to seeing the weather report forecast maybe the heat index for the next day, but that's the ambient outside temperature, so we're focused on the inside temperatures. And we find that if you were to have a blackout during a heat wave that lasted 5 days, that the number of residents that would be exposed to dangerous levels of indoor temperatures and humidity, and these are levels that would be associated with either heat exhaustion or heat stroke. And heat stroke is a deadly episode. Then we found that the number of residents exposed would range from about 70% in Atlanta and Detroit up to 100% in Phoenix. And so were this to occur, a heat wave of historical intensity in Phoenix with a blackout of historical duration, everyone in Phoenix would be at risk of heat illness, either heat exhaustion or heat stroke, and about 70% would confront that risk in Atlanta and Detroit. So these are large numbers for that level of risk.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Georgia Tech professor Brian Stone, Jr. We're talking about a possible mass casualty scenario if the electrical grid goes down during a major heat wave. So beyond a doubt, the world is much hotter than it was in 1950. Heat waves come more often and last longer. So it makes sense sooner or later a blackout will happen during a heat wave. But does the heat make a grid failure more likely, Brian?
Yes, it absolutely does. And so the heat is placing pressure on the grid in terms of demand. And so as temperatures go up, we use our air conditioners more. Those who may not always use their air conditioner will run it full time or be more likely to. And so there's greater demand. But we also see that physically the infrastructure can be stressed as well. And so the most extensive North American blackout was in 2003, where more than 50 million lost their power in both the northeastern U.S. and in Canada. And that resulted from some transmission power lines, high voltage power lines, physically sagging during a heat wave. And so that there was so much heat energy in those power lines that they physically sagged and came in contact with some trees that had not been cleared from the transmission corridor. And that basically shorted out a large fraction of the North American grid. And so heat can absolutely stress our electrical grid in multiple ways.
Well, maybe we should add this. Climate change denial is often stronger in places where the risk of high heat and grid failure are greatest. I'm thinking like in Texas and Arizona. And maybe that leads to inaction and lack of public planning. What do you think?
It's an interesting observation, Alex, that we see more climate denialism in places that confront higher heat risk. I actually haven't considered that or seen a study of that in the past, but typically, in a generic way in the U.S., I think that likely is true, although we do find denialism all over the country. But in the case of Texas, we have, really a textbook example of how climate vulnerability is enhanced when the government is out of step with climate science. Texas is the single state in the United States that has its own division of the national electrical grid. And so, the Northeast has one division of the grid, the Southeast has a division of the grid. And what this means is that all the electrical utilities are interacting and can share electricity across their borders. That's harder to do in Texas because Texas did not want to comply with federal regulations, which are designed to ensure that you have the generating capacity and resilience to manage extreme weather. And so, Texas is confronting greater likelihoods of blackouts because they have opted out of the federal regulatory system. And that is certainly seems to be associated with, to some degree, climate denialism that we see in the state government in Texas.
Are some homes better than others when it comes to surviving a heat wave with no electricity?
Yeah, this was somewhat of a surprising result, at least in my mind, from our study. I mentioned that we looked at different housing types from single-story homes to multi-story homes to apartment buildings. And we actually found that apartment buildings experienced the lowest rise in temperatures during a concurrent heat wave and blackout. And that is because you simply have shared walls, so you have fewer walls that are exposed to direct sunlight in an apartment building. You also have a greater core of air, greater air volume on the interior of that building. And so it just takes more time for the air to circulate throughout an entire apartment building and to distribute that heat than it does in a smaller home. And so a single-story, single-family house, we found to have the highest indoor heat exposures. We also find that that's the housing type across these three cities that is more likely to be occupied by lower-income households. So it's a combination of the design of the structure. They tend to be older structures with poor insulation. And then they also tend to be, in many instances, lower-income families.
Well, thinking about this, it's so shocking. We think, well, what can we do? And you've talked about, changing roof colors, perhaps white, and even road colors, planting more trees. From what you've heard so far, do you think President Joe Biden's infrastructure bill will help strengthen the grid and maybe reduce the risk of this mass casualty event?
I think it will. Now, this remains to be seen in what form it gets passed, if it gets passed at all. But there's $100 billion there, I believe that's the right number, that is focused on increasing grid resilience. And so this is a critical thing that is needed because as heat is increasing, as our demand for electricity is increasing, our national investments in the grid have not kept pace, like all of our infrastructure, really. So that is really an important component of this bill and one that I hope will find its way to finalized legislation. But the other aspect of this you mentioned, we refer to strategies cities can pursue to lower temperatures, basically to cool themselves down. We call that urban heat management. And so planting trees, having more reflective surfaces, these are strategies that work against the urban heat on effect. And we find that these can be very powerful strategies to cool down a city. You can really measurably cool down a heat island by increasing green cover and cool materials over time. To my knowledge, there's nothing in the infrastructure bill that's focused specifically on that. And these are strategies that cities tend to be pursuing, if they are at all, on their own without federal support. But there is a great need for more funding to be focused on climate adaptation, and urban heat management for cities is a key part of that adaptation.
A couple of Australian cities lost power during extremely high heat events. And I'm wondering, do you think your study on extreme heat risks during a power blackout applies to other cities in the world?
Yeah, I do. One of the limitations of our study was that we could only focus on three cities. And the reason we did that is because we are trying to simulate temperature in every single home, every single residential structure in three cities. And so that, you know, it's almost a million structures. And every one of those has its own, basically its own climate model that is running to understand how the climate would change under those conditions. And so we're really limited in terms of computing capacity, how many cities we can look at. But we did focus on very standard building types. And so, you know, we see single-story, multi-story homes, apartment buildings in all cities in all parts of the world. So, you know, in terms of their engineering, they are not so dramatically different that our results would, we'd find our results would vary greatly across these cities. And then we also had a diversity of climate zones. And so we find between 68-70% to 100% of all residents would confront a risk of heat illness or death during a combined blackout and heat wave. And I think that would be true, that range would be true for most large cities across the world.
The hot season is coming in the Northern Hemisphere, and this year may be among the hottest, as all the recent years have been record years. Can we avoid this terrible outcome, Brian, or do you think a mass heat death will have to happen before America really reacts?
Well, I don't want to be overly cynical. I do see that there has been some considered and continued attention on what happened in Texas this winter with a blackout during an extreme winter event. We also saw this in California in the last couple years, a different kind of compound event, which is wildfires that are triggering blackouts and also concurrent with heat waves. And so we had people, you know, in California last summer without power confronting the risk of a wildfire and also during a heat wave. You know, this is kind of a triple threat in that case. And so we are seeing really extreme climate conditions. This will be a reality of our lives moving forward, no matter what we do. And at the same time, that's stressing our infrastructure. And so we should all be prepared for a breakdown in critical infrastructure at the moment it is most needed. And so for some folks who have means, that will mean you might have some backup electrical generation yourself. Cities can quickly pivot and provide backup electrical generation for their cooling centers. They can expand their cooling centers. It does take time to improve the resilience of the grid. It does take time to adapt strategies that will cool down cities or slow the rate of their warming. But providing backup power generation for some large facilities for your critical population during such a compound event is something we can do relatively quickly. And so I hope to see some of these actions happening in the coming years.
I'm also a fan of distributed power. I mean, if people have a decent solar installation on their roof and have the battery power to back it up, they will be able to run their own air conditioners and there will be less stress on great big regional things. I mean, coal plants, nuclear power plants, even gas turbines often have to shut down during extreme heat when we need them the most. So maybe our shift in energy production units will help us too.
You're absolutely right, Axel. I don't think we tote this benefit of renewables enough, is that having a distributed rather than a centralized electrical generation system, or what you're getting is actually multiple systems, provides greater resilience. And so during a storm, for example, something that might bring down a single generating unit may not bring down multiple generating units from, you know, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels, and the ability to support the grid when these traditional fossil-based sources of power production go down. And so I think this is a really important dimension of renewable energy that's not simply related to the fact that they are carbon neutral or mostly carbon neutral, but that they themselves enhance the resilience of the grid and enable us to hopefully have more capacity to weather extreme events.
As we wrap up, what are you and the Urban Climate Lab working on next?
We are most focused on partnering directly with cities to help them adapt. This is our central work, and we're focused on helping cities develop heat management plans. I don't know that there's really a single city in the United States that has a comprehensive heat management plan. And again, heat is the greatest climate-related threat to health moving forward, really across the world. And so cities need to be prepared. There are many things cities can do on their own to reduce the heat risk of their residents. And so we're partnering directly with cities to help develop those plans and really assess what the heat risk is to their neighborhoods and their residents.
We have been speaking with Brian Stone Jr., professor at Georgia Tech and director of the Urban Climate Lab. Find links to his new paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Brian, thank you for developing this story, difficult as it is to hear.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Alex, and your listeners. Thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In 2019, Southern California Edison shut down transmission lines to millions of people during severe heat. Why would they do that? We can ask about that and other reasons why your home and community might lose air conditioning during a heat wave, risking health and even death. Our guide here is Dr. Ray Klump. Ray leads a double life. On the one hand, he is an associate professor of computer and mathematical sciences at Lewis University in Illinois. But Dr. Klump is also software engineer and senior consultant for Power World. There, Ray helps develop software that monitors performance, safety, and security of large electric systems. Ray Klump, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Why would a big electric company like Southern Cal Edison turn off power to their customers during high demand for cooling?
Electricity is a limited commodity. Electricity is not unlimited. There are constraints on how much power can be generated and how much can be delivered. Sometimes those constraints are caused at the generation point, but a lot of times they're caused through the transmission system because there's a limited capacity to transmit power across hundreds of miles. In order to preserve more critical infrastructure, such as hospitals and other very necessary organizations, and keep them up and running, sometimes a utility will have to temporarily suspend service to other customers in order to just keep the lights on and keep those other institutions running. They tend to do this in a rolling sort of way so that they don't plunge somebody into darkness for long periods of time. But it's all about managing the supply because it is limited.
So in some cases, you're talking about a rolling, a kind of brownout rather than a blackout, which is uncontrolled, really. It's maybe a large area and it's dark.
That's right. We want to prevent, the utility wants to prevent that blackout scenario. If they don't act quickly enough to abide by the constraints of the current system, they can end up damaging equipment, which would lead to that uncontrolled scenario that you just described.
Well, dependable electricity is just foundational to everything we do these days. So let's take a dive into how this power gets to our homes and schools and offices. Ray, what happens to power lines during a big heat wave?
So power lines are made of metal, and we know that materials expand when they get hot, and that includes metal. And so a lot of times on a hot summer day, you'll see power lines sag rather significantly. I know that there's a 765 kilovolt line not too far from where I live that stretches across an interstate. And on a hot day, that line really sags. And that's just because of the properties of metal. When it's heated, it expands and it tends to sag. And sometimes it can sag into underbrush below. I believe that happened in California in the late 90s, where sagging transmission lines contacted brush below and ended up shorting out the circuit, and that caused the blackout. So it's a serious concern, and you can see it with your own eyes on a hot day.
Well, maybe we could back up and help me understand something basic, and I'll bet it puzzles a few other listeners too. We picture power stations sending us electricity like Amazon sends us packages. It's one way from them to us. But somehow I'm thinking alternating current, it demands the power station get something back? How does that work? What's behind the need to balance big electric systems?
Well, power will flow where it wants to. It follows the path of least resistance. And so even though a power station may be in your local utility and you think it's generating power for your consumption and your neighbor's consumption, that isn't in reality the case. I mean, if you could somehow track the way electrons were flowing, there aren't particular electrons that are labeled COMET or certain others that are labeled PJM. They are flowing wherever they want to. But overall, this interconnected system, this grid that all these generating systems are contributing into, ends up delivering the power. So although your local utility isn't necessarily serving you directly, they are engaged in a cooperative effort with other utilities to get the power to you.
Can too much power in the system also cause a blackout?
Yes, it can, because you end up blowing equipment, damaging equipment downstream. You know, for example, if you overload a transmission line, fuses, very much like in your house, will blow and interrupt that circuit. And then power can't flow down that line, but it's still in the system. And so that power will find, that electricity will find another path to try to flow through. But in finding another path to flow through, it may overload that alternative path and end up opening it up. And then the outages start to cascade.
I'm thinking of things like Earth Day, where they ask everybody to turn off their lights for a while. If that actually happened, it seldom does, but if it did, would that possibly damage the system if the power companies don't see it coming?
Yes, it could, because when there's not enough consumption, but still the generation is present, you end up having voltages that rise beyond their limits. So, for example, we might expect to get 120 volts out of the wall, but when there's not a lot of consumption, we might see 125 volts or 130 volts come out of that wall. And that can actually damage equipment in our homes. It can end up frying light bulbs prematurely, that sort of thing. But it also can have an impact on equipment that the utility operates as well. So lack of consumption that isn't expected can also cause damage.
I vaguely recall, and I don't have a source to cite here, but it was statements that up to half of electric power generated is lost in the transmission system. Is that true at all?
It is true, because there is resistance in the system, and the amount of loss, usually it ends up as heat, is proportional to the square of the current that is flowing through it. So the more current that is flowing through a transmission line, the higher the losses.
Are there greater losses then in power line transmissions during heat waves?
There are. There are. And that's another constraint on our ability to transmit electricity through transmission lines, particularly long transmission lines, because the longer a transmission line is, the higher the resistance, and therefore the higher the losses.
Well, a 2016 study led by Matt Bartos now at the University of Texas found that by mid-century, rising air temperatures could reduce summertime transmission somewhere between 2% and almost 6% on average relative to what we got around 2010. So the power demand will keep on going up, but we will get hotter. There seems to be a relationship there where we'll have to build more energy just because of climate change.
That is true unless we seek alternatives. For example, there is a push to engage more and more wind, in other words, more local sources of energy, so it doesn't have to be transmitted across long distances, particularly solar, since it's generated practically at the point of consumption. There are also architectural solutions such as incorporating microgrids, which, again, are local distribution generation facilities, so that you are not just relying on getting the power hundreds of miles, but trying to produce it and transmit it closer to where it's actually going to be consumed.
The biggest heat blackout in the U.S. has to be that August 2003 grid failure that darkened a bunch of states in the Northeast, plus Ontario, Canada. Ray Klump, you helped design software to monitor big systems. Have we learned enough to avoid that kind of chain breakdown?
Well, I'd like to say yes, but I think the experience of Texas in February, which was caused by the exact opposite problem, not heat but cold, suggests that preparedness is still a challenge. Now, Texas had some extenuating circumstances. The infrastructure wasn't built for that level of cold. They are more isolated than the rest of the North American grid because they're sort of a kingdom unto themselves. as a, in terms of their electricity production. But it does suggest that, you know, you can never be too prepared. And although we do try to study all sorts of scenarios and contingencies, we have to be always on guard and very diligent in looking out for what could go wrong. We have to be creative in envisioning what the nightmare scenarios would be.
Well, right. Regarding that, Professor Brian Stone just told us about compound events, kind of a convergence of threats to the grid. And there are so many reasons why an electric grid may fail. But one we did not talk about was a terrorist attack timed during a heat wave intending to cause multiple heat deaths. And hacking has brought down power systems. Tell us what happened in the Ukraine in December 2015.
Yeah, so a couple of days before Christmas, hackers broke into the Ukrainian power grid and plunged a large portion of the Ukraine into darkness. And it was perhaps the first known incident of hackers compromising the grid. And when you think about it, the grid is it's a very out in the open kind of network, right? So it's easy to conceive of the possibility for people to bring down that system, either through physical means, right, which is probably the more obvious way because it's so out in the open, but also since the grid is increasingly relying on computers for more efficient operation, it's easy to envision that hackers could break into those computing systems to change settings, to make fuses that guard the transmission lines trip out at lower levels, change how much generation, how much power is coming out of a generation plant. So because there's so much computer control on the grid these days, hackers have more of a target to shoot for. And that is frightening, and it's a real concern.
What if Con Edison or any giant grid operator is hit with ransomware like Colonial Pipelines? Everybody has to worry about that now, too?
Oh, yeah. People are worrying about it, and people are working very, very hard to solidify these systems. Yeah, interestingly, there has always been a little bit of catch-up in the industry. It's not like, I mean, the electrical grid was named one of the top inventions of the 20th century, right? But in a lot of ways, it's very old, staid technology, a lot of electromechanical devices. This move to the smart grid is more recent. This move to integrate more computing power is more recent. And perhaps some of the earlier efforts were not met with the level of rigor that should have been put forth to make sure that they were secure against hackers. And that's true of all computing. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't worry so much about hackers. Now, everybody's much more on guard, and that includes people who try to protect the electrical grid. That being said, there are so many computing devices that are trying to make that grid operate efficiently that it's a tough problem, because the more computing power you have, the more of a target that system is for people who might want to bring it down.
Well, yeah, and then we have state actors. I mean, this is a long-term shot, but various intelligence agencies and media reports suggest that Russia already has the capability to hack American infrastructure from dams to power stations in the grid, and maybe China does too. Do you think that's really possible? I mean, should any of us be concerned about that?
Oh, it's definitely possible, and we do need to be concerned. State-sponsored hacking operations have practically unlimited funds and tremendous expertise, and they engage students of cybersecurity from a very early age, train them in tactical warfare of a sort with the express purpose of gaining leverage over an opponent. And there are some very big fish to catch when it comes to any country and their infrastructure. And surely other countries are eyeing ways to break into our critical infrastructure that includes the power grid. So intrusion detection and response and continuity planning, and redundancy, these are extremely important considerations. If what happened to the Colonial Pipeline were to happen to the eastern interconnect of the power grid, the repercussions would make the Colonial Pipeline incident look like just a minor blip. And yes, we have to be very, very concerned.
And switching to another outlying possibility, in 2017, I interviewed Dr. Peter Pry about the ways an electromagnetic pulse, or an EMP, could knock out large parts of the U.S. electric system, possibly for months, if major transformers were to be wrecked. And that could be due to an atmospheric nuclear detonation or just a very large solar flare that we might not be expecting. Do you think an electronic magnetic pulse could black out large areas? And if so, how ready, how hardened are American electricity providers?
An EMP could cause significant damage over a widespread area. I think it's less of an immediate concern than the thought of, and a less likely concern than a hack would be. But I do know that utility planners and operators do incorporate EMP risk into their studies, particularly their seasonal studies where they try to evaluate the readiness of the grid. So the consideration of EMP and its repercussions, that has become a focus of these kinds of contingency studies. So although it is a concern, I don't see it as big a concern as perhaps state-sponsored hacking.
Fair enough. Now, the United States does not really have a national grid, just 8 large systems, some of them connected to Canadian provincial electric systems. Is that a good thing in terms of avoiding a countrywide blackout or a barrier to distributing power efficiently?
Well, I would argue that what happened in Texas in February wouldn't have happened, or at least wouldn't have been as severe, if Texas had been more strongly interconnected to the rest of the grid. You may or may not know that Texas is an island electrically, and it was planned that way on purpose back in the 1920s to try to avoid federal intervention into their power grid. And if they could rely on power support from their neighboring utilities to meet the shortfall, I think a large portion of the damage they incurred would have been avoided. So the more interconnected the grid can be, the better, because then you can count on your neighbors for support.
What do you think about President Biden's infrastructure proposal? If that was passed, would that make the American electric grid more hardy going into the future?
Absolutely. The electrical grid benefited from the American Recovery Act in 2009. A lot of work went into particularly hardening the cybersecurity of the grid. But it's an aging infrastructure still. And so in addition to incorporating new technologies and protections against hackers, we just simply have to upgrade the more traditional kind of more boring kinds of devices like the transformers and the switchgear and the substations. All that has to be upgraded. And so any additional government support that can go in that direction, I think, will yield benefits when it comes to the reliability of the grid.
Yeah, strangely, it's the transformers that worry me. After doing research into the Fukushima accident and other nuclear needs, we found out that a lot of transformers are custom designed. They're only made by a couple of plants in Asia. They take months to arrive. If a lot of transformers were damaged, that's serious stuff for all of us.
For sure, for sure. And, you know, we don't have, I mean, our supplies of backup transformers are not, it's not a deep bench. So to have more equipment in reserve would help everyone sleep better at night.
In your experience with the company advising big corporations like Commonwealth Edison, the TVA, or Southern, do you sense these essential utilities appreciate the new problems developing as the planet keeps warming up? Are they planning for climate change?
In my dealings, we haven't talked explicitly about climate change. It's always on making sure that the system is reliable, both with short-term studies and longer-term studies. I have not myself been involved in projects that are directly addressing the possibility of the worldwide temperature increasing by 2 degrees. However, I think implicit in the long-term projections is the notion that the demand is increasing. Demand will always be increasing. How can we plan now for increased demand 5 to 10 years down the road? So I don't know that, you know, there's an explicit acknowledgement of the impacts of climate change, but I do know that utilities take their responsibility to keep the lights on today and tomorrow very seriously.
What else are you working on these days, Ray Klump?
So one of my research focus areas is on the cybersecurity of the grid. And so that includes autonomous agents on the grid that try to eke as much room for electrons to flow as possible. So in other words, not having to build major new infrastructure, but rather squeeze more out of the existing grid through advanced technologies and more efficient controls. And so with that, with computer control, automatic computer control, you need to consider ways for these devices to authenticate to each other so that if you do have a network of devices that are trying to cooperate in making the power flow more efficiently, that there aren't rogue devices introduced into the system or devices that have been hacked that would counteract that behavior. And so that's one of my focus areas. Anything related to the cybersecurity of the grid and automatic control, those are my interests these days.
Well, we're glad you're there. We've been speaking with computer and electric system expert Dr. Ray Klump, and he's associated with Lewis University in Illinois and designs software for electric grid operators in a company called Power World. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Ray, thank you for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I have just a few minutes to update you on a controversy covered on this show several times. Is the huge loss of Arctic sea ice cover changing both the jet stream and the climate further south? Rutgers scientist Jennifer Francis has been one of several experts on this program saying sea ice was a factor, possibly even for abnormal cold air falling down into North America and Europe in recent years. Francis was reporting observations, she told us that, two concurrent events. But there was lots of debate among scientists about whether sea ice was a cause or the distorted polar vortex was just maybe a limited event which would return to its former swirl around the high Arctic. Dr. James Screen from the University of Exeter has been working on this problem for at least half a decade. He just published a study showing, in the words of Paul Voosen at Science Magazine, quote, "Even after the massive sea ice loss expected by mid-century, the polar jet stream will only weaken by tiny amounts, at most only 10% of its natural swings. And in today's world, the influence of ice loss on winter weather is negligible," says James Screen. End quote from Paul Voosen. Francis now says we know systems in the Arctic are far more complex. In fact, Francis and Screen were co-authors of a 2016 article finding that Pacific atmospheric conditions were a large driver of Arctic sea ice loss. Well, that's my understanding of it. Better check the paper with the link in my blog at ecoshock.org. It is easier to understand what these scientists are arguing against than what they are arguing for, but that is one of the methods of seeking truth, isn't it? Eliminating suspects. It appears that some of the speculation from Francis, agreed by many other scientists, including Paul Beckwith, is now being questioned. The jet stream is more wavy than in the 1950s, according to new research, but not by that much. And we don't know the cause. It may not be related to the Arctic sea ice decline, and that surprises me too. Reality is always shrouded in a layer of possibilities, I suppose. The human mind is limited and self-deceiving. Science always has to question itself. On the little matter of heat waves in May all the way to the Arctic, I can only think of one minor question for you. Where should you be living in 2030? Is it safe for you and your family to stay where you are now? Because it takes a few years to really go anywhere, to change routes, to change patterns, to change an economy. Think about it. If you do need to go somewhere, maybe you are in a good place. Sadly, governments are not planning for a new reality. They're not even willing to plan to save us from catastrophic warming. Not really. There's nothing happening, not enough to do it. So, it's up to us. What will you do? What will we do? Thank you for being so patient to work through difficult issues in new science like this. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.